All right, it is that time again. The threshold. That's awesome. All right. That's Madeline. Okay. So, once again, we're at that point. Put a line in your notes. We're done with the stuff for exam two, and we're moving on to exam number three. So, now that we're past spring break, it's also time that I'm going to start giving at least hopefully weekly reminders about your paper. Your paper is due at the end of April, the 20-something, 21st-ish or so. So keep that in mind. You still have until the end of the month to get extra credit if you're going to do early submission. But keep in mind, when you do deposit it in the Dropbox in Engage, make sure you go to lemanic.com or proflemanic.com. Actually, I think both links work. And check the paper section out. Make sure you understand how the paper is going to be graded. Follow the directions, because it would be really bad to try to get extra points and end up getting a bad grade because you didn't follow the directions. Thus far, I had one individual submit their paper, not in this class, in one of my other classes, but he's somebody who already had me for three classes, so he already knows how I grade the paper. So we ended up doing quite well on the paper. But one down, a whole bunch to go. So I asked him, how come you got it in so early? He's like, man, I had time, so I figured I'd just get it out of the way. So I'm just throwing that out there. Obviously, it's not due until the due date, but if you do have some time in the coming weeks, it's not that long of a paper. If you want to just kind of bang it out, it might be a good thing. And again, if you get it in by the end of the month, you'll be able to get a few extra points on it. As far as the grades on exam number two, I will open them up once I got a couple of more baseball players that still need to take the exam, or at least touch base and tell me when they want to take the exam. So as soon as they reach out and we can get that done, it will be done. My two softballers got it done. Thank you. So we can check that off the list. I got my hockey player. That's good, too. So it's just a couple of baseball players we got to track down. All right. Exam number three. We've already dealt with the Crusades, the Middle Ages, the violence and destruction of that time period. We talked about the emergence of kings motivated by financial incentive. It's the reason why they pushed for the age of exploration. But when we started talking about that, I mentioned the fact that one of the things that kings, why the kings pursued that is because they felt empowered, emboldened to do it because of all the embarrassments and humiliations that the church suffered. So the kings were less willing to seek out the blessings of the Pope before they did things. And that obviously gave rise to the age of exploration. It would also give rise to significant political changes, which we're going to talk about. But before we get to that, we got to deal with religion. Because everything, and it's true today, everything that goes on in the world, no matter what it is, impacts other areas of life. And sometimes things spiral out of control and seek to destroy old institutions, particularly institutions that had become corrupted from its original intent. And essentially, that's what would occur. But just to be remind you all, kings were motivated by the more. They wanted to expand outward. They wanted to gain more power. They wanted to build larger armies. They did so by conquering new lands. But there were also the desires of some of the kings on the continent to recreate Rome. The kings of France, the various rulers in Germany, even the kings of England, dreamed of conquering the continent. In order to do so, they had to raise their revenue, raise their power. But of course, no one was strong enough to have victory. So that's one of the reasons why the easier path was to go global. There also were all the bad things that we covered. There was the plagues and the famines and the warfare. Violence, death was all around. And I touched upon it briefly. But I think there's a section in your reader that deals with the danse macabre. You know, the fascination, the cult-like worship of death. You know, when you look back at what those people dealt with, it's similar to what we deal with at certain periods of time. But we have become insulated from death. You take your parents or your grandparents when they get older and you put them in old age homes and then they die there and you don't have to deal with, you know, picking up after the mess and dealing with the bodies. There are businesses that do that. So we're removed. But during this time period, there was death all around and it had a significant impact on people's minds. And they began questioning. You know, during the feudal period, the people never thought of the kings. They thought of their local nobles because their nobles controlled their lives. But the nobles couldn't protect them from famine and plague and war. Others looked to the church. And, well, the church really didn't help either. Well, when these two institutions became destabilized, it's one of the things that allowed the kings to begin consolidating power at home, because those checks and balances were removed. All the chaos also sparked an economic revolution. We touched upon it briefly. With the bubonic plague killing one third of the population, a lot of the peasants decided they didn't want to live in the countryside anymore. So they moved to the cities and they started making money with their hands. They became skilled artisans and carpenters and jewelry makers is fine. Heck, we'll even throw in candle makers and bakers. You know, they realized they didn't have to serve as laborers for a local lord. Ironically, in some pockets, you saw the development of proto-capitalism, where people were motivated to work harder because they could make more money. One of the greatest opportunities came in the form of colonies. You could be a dirty, stinking peasant at home, but if you got on a ship and you risked everything, sailed across the world, you could become fabulously wealthy. Colonies provided opportunity, chances for innovation, and access to resources. But at the end of the day, so much more was being produced and produced faster that a new money class emerged, a middle class. People who didn't own land, didn't have traditional rights and privileges, but had big rolls in their wallets. And they basically said, hey, we got cash. We want to have equal representation. All of this was new. And of course, it would impact the one thing that used to hold Europe together. Keep that in mind from really when the Franks during the... Well, I guess you could say during the Merovingian as well as the Carolingian periods when they converted to Catholicism and they started spreading the cross across the continent, you know, maybe from around 900 AD all the way up to 1500, there was one church. Everybody, whether you were English or Spanish or German, everybody was Catholic. It was the one thing everyone had in common. But all of this started impacting the one thing they had in common. Now, this was not a ground-up change, though. A movement. It wasn't a ground-up movement, a revolution, whatever you want to refer to it. Because at the lowest level, the average person was illiterate, the average person was superstitious, and their only concern was avoiding hell. That's all they were worried about. But as we saw, the people who had the biggest issues with the church were members of the church. They were from within. These were intellectuals, scholars that worked in the universities. All men of the cloth. And they began questioning not the faith, not the beliefs, but the way the church operated, the practices. They were concerned that popes were more interested in political outcomes than saving people. Popes were more concerned with filling the coffers in Rome than serving the people. And so these scholars started doing the one thing that people in power are absolutely terrified of: questioning. Questioning. You all know that, right? People who are in power don't like being questioned. And they'll do anything to squash people who question them. Because how dare you ask them questions? You just have to obey. Take my man Marsiglio of Padua. We talked about him. He turned around, as we know, and basically said that it should be the emperor that have control over the popes. That the emperor, as the secular authority, should be able to punish popes. And of course, that all priests, regardless of title, should be all the same. You know, a pope shouldn't be more powerful than a priest. You know, a cardinal shouldn't be more powerful than a bishop. You know, you're all members of the church. You're all equal. We know the church didn't like that. Declared him a heretic. Tried tracking him down. But they were unsuccessful. Then there was Wycliffe. Wycliffe, as we know, similarly, said that kings should be the authority in the land, but people should obey the kings first and foremost. Why? Because kings in the realm are accountable to God. Wycliffe also said there should be a church council. That people at the lowest levels should have a say how the higher level operates. He suggested bottom up. And that's one of the reasons why he translated the Bible into English. Because he wanted the people to be able to read the Bible for themselves so they could ask questions. Like, where in the Bible does it say that the Pope is all powerful? A super emperor? I read the Bible. The New and the Old Testament. I've never seen those passages or references. So if the Bible doesn't say it, how, where does the Pope get off saying that he can tell a king what to do? Well, you know what happened to him. Posthumously declared a heretic. His body was exhumed, chopped up into little bits and burned. And his ashes were thrown into the river. Then there was Jan Hus. Similarly thought people should read the Bible for themselves. Similarly thought that people should ask questions. But he, of course, argued that the church is an institution made by man. And thus every person has a right to question it. Because the Bible is the only source of faith. He was tricked. He was tricked into going before the council in Clermont. Found guilty of heresy. Burned at the stake. Not once, but not twice, but thrice. Ashes thrown into the river. And then his believers were attacked by the church. Crusades were launched. All because they questioned authority. Questions. We also know a little bit about the Renaissance. The Renaissance started in Italy and eventually would shift north throughout all of Europe. One of the biggest components of the Renaissance was taking Latin out of literature and replacing it with the language of the land, the language that the people spoke, the language that more people had a chance to read. So if you print something in a language that only less than 1% can read, you create a monopoly on knowledge of the truth. And you have to rely upon the people and their interpretation to be truthful. But if they have an agenda, you're going to get false information. To give you a potential shocking, controversial example, an analogy, how many of you actually trust the news? I don't care what channel it is. Any of you actually trust them? You think they're actually telling you the truth? There's not a single network out there on the left wing or the right wing that tells the truth. It's all agenda. It's all spin. It's all lies. So how do you find the truth? Well, you can't trust someone to tell you what the truth is. You've got to find it. And that's what the Northern Renaissance represents. People basically saying, we're not going to trust the institution. We got to be able to look for ourselves. And so what happened was intellectuals started appearing. And they started asking questions. They started asking, why is the church off the rails? Why is the church corrupt? If scripture says one thing and the church is doing the exact opposite, why? Well, if the church is so wrong, then yes, maybe those earlier writers that were saying we need to empower the kings, maybe the kings are the solutions. Maybe the kings should resist a corrupt pope. I mean, after all, if you know a leader is corrupt and you willingly obey, does that not make you an accomplice? There were some that went so far as to even say, and we're talking in the 14th and 15th centuries, there were some people, we only covered the big ones, but there were other writers that went so far as to question the need for the church itself. The institution was so corrupt it can't be saved. Let's just destroy it and replace it with Jesus' original intent, local communities. Many people wanted change. They were just fed up. They were done. They wanted to save their souls. They wanted to focus on Jesus' actual words as laid out in Scripture because their trust was gone. We know how he contributed. Desiderius Erasmus, the so-called Prince of the Humanists. As we covered previously, we know one of the foremost thinkers of his day. He studied and taught at the best universities. But a lot of his knowledge wasn't just book knowledge. It wasn't just theory. It was practical knowledge. because he spent as much time in the villages, in the small towns, interacting with real people as he did in the esteemed halls of learning. And he came to realize that there are egomaniacs, there are hypocrites everywhere. And those are the people who should be mocked. Because they're fake. Classic example. Do any of you worship at the altar of Hollyweird? None of you worship Hollywood actors and actresses? No, you shouldn't. Those people made lots of money engaged in make-believe, fantasy. They don't think, they're given their words that they're to speak. They're not real. So they should be mocked. I love it when an actor or an actress comes out and engages in politics. Because you end up listening to them and they're so stupid. I'll give you a right-wing example. Let's bash the right-wing because we'll be fair. When Kid Rock came out and was against Bud Light, because of Dylan Mulvaney. He did his little TikTok video where he took his guns and he blew up a case of Bud Light. Did you hear him talk about Bud Light recently? Now he's attacking people that don't drink Bud Light anymore. It's like, dude, if you have a principle, stand on your principle. But you don't, because it's all about the Benjamins. It's all about getting the likes. So you're going to put your finger to the wind and you're going to do whatever you think is popular. It's not real, but so many people lose their minds and they worship at the feet of those people. Well, Erasmus would just be in heaven if he was to come into modern society, because everywhere you look, there's people that just think that they are flawless, that they're perfect, but they're not. They're not. So they should be mocked. And again, Praise of Folly. That's exactly what he did in his book. But his natural tendencies to dig down below the veneer to look for the truth is ultimately what makes him a historical controversial figure. When he wrote Textus Receptus, should be in your notes. When he took the Vulgate, the Latin Bible, and translated it back into Greek. And when he did so, he found flaws. He found books that were in the Vulgate that weren't in the original Greek sources. He found words that didn't translate exactly as they were written in Latin. Textus Receptus. Textus Receptus. In the Renaissance section. Sydney.
Thank you.
Yep. Well, what he ended up doing in printing this book, and it was circulated, is it caused other intellectuals to sit back and say, whoa, 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 whoa. The church bases its power over the lives of human beings on the Bible. But if their version of the Bible is not right, are they legit? Is their power, is their claim of authority, is it justified? Or is it wrong? And if it's wrong, and you obey, are you going to risk your soul on that? Huge, huge, huge controversy. What's today's date?
12th.
All right. Don't write this. Don't write this. Don't write this. At around the time, a monk by the name of Martin Luther appeared. And a few decades later, a writer, looking back at what transpired, wrote this. This is an epigram, which is a short, truthful saying. Where Erasmus merely nodded, Luther rushed in. Where Erasmus laid the eggs, Luther hatched the chicks. Where Erasmus merely doubted, Luther laid down the law. See, what Erasmus represents, chances are it's going to happen to you at some point in your life. Maybe multiple times. When you're going to have a question of faith, not just religious, but your belief in something is going to be shaken. And you're going to ask questions. And Erasmus did that. But you know the one thing he didn't do? He didn't reject the church. At the end, he remained a devoted member of the faith. And once the church started getting all up in arms, he simply put his head down and backed off. But when he raised the questions, it provided others opportunity to build upon it. And one of the first people to do it was a lowly monk in the province of Saxony, in the city of Wittenberg, a man by the name of Martin Luther. Not Martin Luther King, Jr. Martin Luther, an Augustinian monk, who laid down the ultimate barrage of questions. Questions that the church could not respond to. On October 31st, 1517, as popular legend has it, he took his 95 theses, his 95 questions, went to the Grand Cathedral in the middle of the city, and nailed it to the door as a challenge to the church. Now, truth be told, there's no factual evidence that supports this story. What he did is he wrote his 95 theses and he began circulating it amongst his colleagues because he wanted to have an intellectual discussion. Martin Luther, a German monk, a member of the Augustinian order. Now, as you may know, there are different orders of monks in the church. During this time period, the Augustinian order was largely like the archivists. They were like the librarians. Members of the Augustinian order worked in what were called scriptoriums. And they'd take the old parchment scrolls and they would painstakingly, by hand, write out every single word. And they would take that and they would archive it. Any piece of literature. He also would become a theology professor, teaching at the University of Wittenberg. Well, as a member of the Augustinian order, he had access to the libraries. And one of the things that the church did well was preserve knowledge. Books that they condemned as heresy were recorded and archived. Books that they supported were recorded in archive. Didn't matter what it was, everything was written down. Now the good books, they allowed to be published. The bad books, they tried walking away. But what they didn't do is they didn't destroy it. So men like Luther had the ability to go down and to read the books. At a young age, he read Marsiglio, he read Wycliffe, he read Huss, he read all of the people associated with the conciliarist movements. And when you read something, it should spark curiosity. And Luther, internally, started questioning. So, when he wrote his 95 theses, he wasn't trying to drop a nuclear bomb on the church. He wasn't trying to blow it all up. He wanted to have a dispensation, a dialogue, a discussion, a debate with other intellectuals. But what he ended up doing is he ended up lighting a match that eventually would cause half of Europe to break away from the Catholic Church. Questions? All right. But how does one have the courage to stand up on principle? Well, courageous people are not just born. If you look throughout all of history, any individual who dared to stand up, they were usually pushed to get to that point. Things happened in their lives that inspired them to get to that point. And Luther's experience happened 6 years before he would actually put his questions to paper. It began when he did one of the things that monks were supposed to do. All monks of all orders were at some point in their life supposed to make a pilgrimage to Rome, to worship in St. Peter's Basilica, to travel to the ancient holy sites in the city, and if possible, have audience with the Pope himself. Well, Luther's chance came.